From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. Visit them on the web at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hello, and welcome to episode 36 of the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. I am your host and Diz historian Michael Bowling, and I am joined by my good friend, co-host, and producer, Craig Williams. Craig, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you, Michael?
I'm fine, thank you, and congratulations on the second anniversary of our being together on the Connecting with Walt podcast.
Gosh, yeah, it has been 2 years now. It's flown by.
Yeah, now the traditional second anniversary gift is cotton, so of course we should celebrate with a gift of Connecting with Walt shirt from Tee Public.
I just thought the exact same thing.
So, do you watch Adam the Woo, do you follow him on YouTube?
I do, yeah. No, so I was just one of the many people who was surprised when Bob Gurr popped up in one of his daily vlogs and was wearing the Connecting with Walt shirt again.
Yeah, that red Connecting with Walt shirt. Boy, on that day that happened, my social media sort of lit up as everybody was posting the video and pictures from it, and I got instant messages with links to it. Oh, yeah. So it was wonderful. So, you know, after Adam the Woo photobombed us at D23, it was. I feel like, okay, this is a nice, you know, little payback for that.
It's so funny that it happened.
Yeah. So, so many thanks to Bob Gurr for being a Connecting with Walt fan, wearing that shirt. So, Craig, what have you been up to since July when we last met, except for that one bonus episode in September?
Oh, just, you know, everything that's been happening with the Diz. It feels like it's been nonstop now for quite a while. So I genuinely don't even remember what's been happening, but a lot. Yeah. So just go with that.
Well, you've had some weather.
Yes, we had. That's right. We had a hurricane somewhere in there, and I mean, hopefully, as we always pre-record these in advance, hopefully, I can say that it was just one hurricane this year.
Yes, that's what I'm hoping to. Yes. But I'm glad that everybody on the Diz got through it, and of course, for everybody that is still feeling the effects of all the storms, because as of this recording, there have been multiple storms hitting the United States, the Caribbean. Some of our territories, our hearts go out to you, and you're in our thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did have a couple of things going on. I gave a talk at the Walt Disney Family Museum for the San Francisco City Guides. It was about Walt Disney's connections to Northern California. It was entitled Go North, Young Mouse, Walt Disney's Adventures in Northern California. And that was very popular. It went over really well. It was a very daunting experience to, you know, be speaking, telling stories about Walt Disney and the building that's dedicated to telling his life story. And it was a great honor to be asked by a Dizzer, who's a listener to this show, Eric, who is responsible for continuing education for their tour guides. And so, because the tour guides have to earn a certain amount of credits every year so that they stay current on, you know, the history of San Francisco. So the tour guides do make available, the city guides make available some opportunities for them to gain these credits, and Eric's responsible for that. And so, and actually, the funny thing is, I met Eric on one of the Diz cruises.
Oh, really?
Years ago. Yeah. So, and then he is a member of the Walt Disney Family Museum. So, we renewed our acquaintance you know, when the museum mm-hmm. opened, and then and just got to be friends. And we were a few years ago, we were at a talk on the World's Fairs. Mm-hmm. And Marty Sklar was actually one of the presenters, and they talked about, you know, it was more about the 64-65 World's Fair, but yeah. somebody gave a presentation on the 1939 exposition that was on Treasure Island in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and that Walt had visited the fair, and that sparked an idea by Eric that could there possibly be, you know, what? How many connections did Walt have to Northern California? And was there enough material to actually do a full-blown presentation? And so Eric and I talked about it. I said, let me do a little research. And I said, sure enough, there was plenty of material out there. So we worked on it. And the Walt Disney Family Museum offered to be the hosts for the talk, and they were wonderful to work with, and it really went off well. It was a sold out theater, and it was a very nice experience, and I'm very grateful to the museum and to Eric and the San Francisco City Guides for
awesome.
Being wonderful hosts. And so if you're ever in San Francisco, you know, sign up for a San Francisco City Guide tour. It's really fascinating, and San Francisco has a very rich history. And speaking of the museum, as we'll talk later on about the Diane Disney Miller Lifetime Achievement Award, we're going to give a mention to it later on in this show. They are going to have their 2017 gala on November 7th. They're going to honor John Lasseter, who's the chief creative officer at Pixar and Walt Disney Animation Studios, with the Diane Disney Miller Lifetime Achievement Award. So you might want to, if you want to find out more information about this, maybe you want to attend, you can go on to the museum's website, waltdisney.org, for more information about that. And then just recently, I think both of us have been guests recently on podcasts. I was on the Leaving Today podcast, which debuted a few weeks ago, and they talk about Disneyland, and they had me on as a guest to talk a little about Disneyland, and it was we had a really fun time. And
awesome.
It turns out they are based out of the Sacramento, California area where I'm at. So that was nice as well. And Craig, you were on a guest on a podcast as well.
Yeah, I was. And not Disney for mine. It was the unofficial Universal Orlando podcast. Just a great team together that really, I mean, they've put in over 200 episodes now about Universal Orlando. I think they have more than any other Universal podcast out there. So just a top-notch group of people. And we did a really big tribute on Dragon Challenge, since that was the attraction that I worked at right before I left Universal and came to work for the Diz. So I was able to share a lot of secrets and stories from behind the scenes, and just give a general sense of what it was also like to work at Universal. So if you're even interested in, you know, maybe not the attraction itself, but the day-to-day of what my life kind of was back when I worked at Universal, definitely check it out and check out some of their other shows. So they do a lot of great work, especially when it comes to trying to preserve a lot of history with Universal.
That's great. Yeah, and Leaving Today podcast, I'm the feature presentation, so I'm actually towards the end of the podcast after they take some listener phone calls. So just to give you a heads up on that it's a bit of a lengthy show. It's a fascinating and fun show, but I am towards the end of it, in case you're sitting there thinking, well, where is he? Like I said, they keep their featured segment is always towards the end of the podcast. So anyway, and let's put links in our show notes to both of these.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. Okay. Imagineering and Disney legend Marty Sklar passed away at his Hollywood Hills home on Thursday, July 27th, 2017, at the age of 83. The announcement of Marty's passing was a surprise to the Disney fan community, since he had appeared to be in good spirits 10 days previously at the D23 Expo in Anaheim. Because of Marty's many contributions to the Walt Disney Company and his direct connection to Walt, rather than talking about his career ourselves, Craig and I wanted to have a guest who knew Marty and could speak about him personally. And the first person I thought of was Disney historian, author, and friend of the Diz, Jim Corcus. So, Jim, welcome back to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast.
Well, thank you so much. I guess Diz Unplugged is so frugal they can't bring in someone like a Tony Baxter or whatever to talk about. Or maybe it's just I'm the last man standing. People like John Hench, who knew him very well, we've lost so many terrific Disney legends, and suddenly I find myself in the unusual situation of being one of the few people who actually got to talk to a lot of these people at length, and now people come running to me and say, well, what would Ward Kimball say about this, or what would... And so I feel a great obligation to keep telling the stories that they told me that may not be familiar to a larger audience, and to keep it accurate and to keep their, mm-hmm. their memories alive. But boy, I never in my life thought I would be in that position, or else I would have taken much better notes and would have carried a tape recorder with me everywhere I went. But I'm going to do the best I can. I have an awful lot of respect and affection for Marty. And as you mentioned, was completely taken by surprise with his passing. And on a personal level, I was taken by surprise because I was finishing up my latest book, and he had agreed to do the foreword for it. So that was a surprise. He hadn't started on the foreword. He was about 75% through his third book, and I hope that somebody will pick up the baton there and finish that up, because I certainly enjoyed his first two books.
Yes.
And I don't think we can get enough of Marty and his insights. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to share some of the stories that I've heard from Marty over the decades.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. And how did you come to know Marty Sklar?
Well, he owed me money. And no. what happened is before I was a Disney historian and before I was a Disney cast member, I was a Disney fan, and I lived in the Los Angeles area. And in the 1980s, which is when I first met Marty, there were two fan clubs, the National Fantasy Fan Club, which is now called the Disneyana Fan Club, and the Mouse Club. And they held show and sales, and they held conventions. In fact, their conventions were so popular that Disney then co-opted and started doing the Disneyana conventions, which I and a lot of other people miss. But anyway, at these conventions, they would invite these people like Bill Evans and Bill Justice and Mark Davis, all of that, and Marty Sklar was invited, and that was the first time I got to meet him. After the presentation, I went up and just like a typical Disney fan, gushed about, you know, I'd like to be an Imagineer, and you know, you knew Walt and what was Walt like, and all of that, and he was very patient and very gracious and actually signed a book for me because he wrote the original Disneyland book, mm-hmm. 1964 and 1965, that was in the park. It's just called Disneyland. And I think it's credited to Martin Sklar in there, and he signed that, and so he was very nice. And then over a period of time, we kept running into each other, so we weren't best buddies, but he did recognize me when he saw me, and he did have a smile on his face when he saw me, so that was a good thing. And when I moved out to Florida to take care of my parents, I started working for Walt Disney World, and he would sometimes come and do presentations for cast members, or even came out one time and did a book signing and all of that. And so every now and then we would hook back up. And I also write a continuing column for the Disney Vacation Club magazine, which is called Disney Files. And he wrote for that as well. And one of the compliments that I'll take with me to my grave is he told the editor, Ryan March, he said, "I really love Jim's stuff because it's accurate and it brings back memories." And I thought, how kind, how gracious to be able to do that. You know, for the general public, movie and TV stars, sports figures, you know, those are the big celebrities. But for those of us who are Disney fans, it's the Disney animators and the Imagineers who are the celebrities. You know, I think they should have trading cards. You know, I'd love to have a rookie year trading card of Tony Baxter or Joe Rohde, you know, in my my collection. And certainly Marty Sklar, my gosh, 54 years with the company. And I will tell you this too, because I'm going to present Marty in an honest way. He did not want to go. When when they made him the ambassador to Imagineering in 2006, Marty said, "Yeah, they made me president of Rocks and Trees," and that was basically it. He says they don't invite me to the meetings anymore. I'm not copied on any of the meetings. They're not interested in this. But he had become so prominent that how do you push out Marty Sklar? Well, the Disney company pushes out people by sort of minimizing their influence. So, for instance, they had a film archivist, and instead of firing him, because, again, he was very prominent, he had made all these discoveries, a lot of those special supplements on DVDs and Blu-rays had come from his research, but Disney is a very political organization. They didn't really want him to remain. So one Monday morning, he came into his office, and there was a desk and a chair and a phone, and that was it. So he thought, well, it's time for me to go. Well, with Marty, Marty would have stood there until, you know, by golly, you know, he just dropped over. But the Disney company decided, for whatever reason, no, it's about time for you to move on. You know, maybe they wanted fresh blood or a new perspective, or more likely, they do like to get rid of those people who, you know, knew Walt and knew Roy, because they'll stand up and they'll say, "Hey, you know, Walt would have preferred doing it this way." You know, well, that's not cost effective for us. So, and then, you know, he stuck it out. He stuck it out till 2009, before he retired. And Marty was what we called at Disney a good soldier. And even after he retired, he was a good soldier. And basically what that meant was, when Disney made a change that they felt that the fans might not, you know, cheer, they would trot out Marty, who could say, "Well, I actually knew Walt, And Walt probably would have approved of this change. And the last time we saw that was when Disney made the announcement of the change of the redhead in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's a pirate with a musket, and you know, none of the women are for sale and all of that. And sure enough, they pulled Marty out to say, well, you know, Walt never wanted people to feel uncomfortable, so this change is probably good. I ran into that with Carousel of Progress when the rumor was that Carousel of Progress was going to close, and I was writing an article, and I was hoping that Marty would give me a quote of, you know, no, all this needs is some tender, loving care and all this. And what he basically said was, well, you know, I rewrote that final scene at least twice. And, you know, sometimes these attractions no longer meet the entertainment needs of a modern audience. And I'm going, who is this guy? You worked on this. You worked on this for the World's Fair. You worked on, you know.
Well, this is the man who said he would, you know, lie down across Harbor Boulevard before they'd shut down, you know, the submarine voyage.
Yes. And again, a lot of times he did that behind the scenes. Because he was very, he had strong opinions. I remember him telling me, boy, we made a mistake with Disney California Adventure. You know, we went on the cheap, and boy, that came back to bite us on the butt. And I pulled out quotes of his from when Disney California Adventure first opened, you know, how this is a new, you know, era for Disney, and what a wonderful. And so one of the reasons he lasted 54 years was he understood that Imagineering and Disney is a very political organization. I always tell people, everybody thinks it's one happy magic kingdom. It's actually a bunch of separate fiefdoms, and they all report to the same king. But oftentimes they try to cut the legs out from under other fiefdoms so that they look taller, that they look bigger. And, you know, in fact, Imagineering almost died when Walt Disney passed away. I don't know if the two of you know that story or not.
I knew that it was going to be shut down.
Yes. Well, and the reason why is because it was Walt's playground.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want non-creative people there. And so Roy Disney had only been there once, maybe twice. Card Walker and Don Tatum had never been there. And so here you have Walt announcing, you know, we're going to do this Florida project. And the people who are in charge of the company have no idea what Imagineering does and whether they'd be capable of doing any of this. And so Marty and John Hench were, a team at Imagineering, and we can talk about that, and we can talk about what John told Marty on his very first day in Imagineering. But basically, they had to build this bridge and demonstrate, yes, we can do this project. You know, we want to do this project. And, because they were going to shut down Imagineering because nobody was quite sure what they did. You know, they were billing, you know, Walt Disney Productions, you know, an awful lot of money. But nobody knew because Walt didn't want the other people there. This was his private laughing place for that mm-hmm. to happen. And so Marty said that was one of the scariest times because, as you said, it was like, well, we don't know what this is, but it's costing us money. Let's shut it down.
Yeah, yeah. Now, for some of our, especially our younger listeners who might not fully know about Marty's career, how did he get started
That's a great question, and I'm sure some of your younger listeners have no idea who I am either. But I hope to be entertaining enough that they'll keep listening here.
Oh, they know who you are because they listen to the show religiously. They've heard you before.
Well, that's good. I hope they'll keep listening with this. Well, Marty. It came from New Jersey to California in, summer of 1946, because his mother lived in Los Angeles. And so the whole family decided to move out here because, you know, New Jersey, Los Angeles, you know, what makes better sense here? And his dad became principal of Madison Junior High School in North Hollywood. So those of you in the Southern California area, you can wander by there and go, oh, look at that. And Marty had a brother, Bob, who became a professor of cinema studies at NYU. And he passed away. He wrote a bunch of books. So Marty is coming from a family that is very academically oriented, very much into reading, very much into words. And so he went to UCLA, which at that time, and still today, very prestigious Southern California school. And he had finished his junior year, and summer was just starting, summer of June 1955. He was 21 years old. He was going to be a senior when the fall happened, and he was going to be editor of the UCLA student newspaper, the UCLA Bruin. And actually, Marty's goal when he was in college was he thought that he was going to end up and be a sports writer for newspapers. I don't think people knew that. So anyway, one of his classmates was actually in Disney marketing and recommended that Marty be brought in because Walt wanted to have a newspaper, an 1890s-style newspaper for Disneyland. And so Card Walker called and left a message, and Marty thought, somebody's yanking my chain here. Who's called Card, right? must be a card dealer from Las Vegas, you know, like that. Fortunately, Card phoned back and brought him in and did a 20-minute interview with him, which actually was pretty amazing for Card Walker, because Card Walker wanted to get, you know, bing, right to the point, and then we go on from there. And so explained, you know, what he wanted. And then Marty met with Walt. And Marty told me, you know, even though he had a brief meeting with Walt, he said, I learned so much from that meeting. First off, I learned that here it is June. The park's going to open in July. I knew there was chaos. You know, things weren't being completed. Things weren't getting paid. And yet he had time to sit down and talk with me about this 10-cent tabloid newspaper, you know, that was going to be sold at Disneyland. And I thought, my gosh, this guy, you know, really cares about every detail about Disneyland. And the second thing he learned was that, well, of course, Walt thought of Main Street, USA, as a real town. It's not an amusement park. It's a real town. And every real small town had its own newspaper. So having a Main Street, USA, and not having a newspaper, you don't have a complete story. You need to have all those little details that add to telling the story. And Marty said, you know, that type of stuff just stuck in my mind when I was eventually hired. So he was hired part-time in June of 55, which is a month before the park opened. And he had been doing all sorts of odd jobs, you know, to pay for his college. He actually was a riveter for a while. He was a temporary postman, whatever. So anyway, he having worked on the school newspaper, he knew, you know, printers in the Los Angeles area and who might have a 1890s font and whatever. And so he put together a dummy first issue, and Walt absolutely loved it. And we need to realize, too, that the newspaper was not just for Disneyland. You know, Steve Martin used to sell it out in front of the park. Tom Nabby, who is Tom Sawyer, used to sell it out in front of the park. And if you sold a certain number of copies, you were allowed to come into Disneyland for free. So that encouraged these teenage boys to sell this. But one of the other purposes of the Disneyland News was to put it in local motels and hotels so that people staying there would pick that up. And there were advertisements, you know, for the restaurants in there and the shops and all that. And so people would go, well, hey, maybe I should go take a look at this. Well, again, it's a tabloid newspaper, so, you know, it gets torn up, it gets roughed up. And so by 57, Marty was in charge of helping put together a magazine called Disneyland Holiday. And then Holiday Magazine threatened to sue, so they changed it to Vacation Land Magazine. And that lasted, you know, for over a decade. So anyway, Marty does the first issue and oversees, you know, the continuing issues. But he goes back to UCLA and graduates and then gets hired full-time September 56. And he's put in charge. The newspaper's still coming out, so he's still doing that as responsibility. But he's put in charge with Disneyland Publicity, being overseen by Eddie Meck. And at first, he was in the administration building backstage, which was the old Ron Dominguez house. And then all of Publicity moved over to City Hall. And they took over the entire second floor and some of the bottom floor. But since Marty was low man on the totem pole, he was put in the police station, which was that little building right next to where the Disneyland tour guides meet now, you know, and have that. Mm-hmm. And he said it was a great learning experience because people would wander in thinking, you know, this is an official office and I got questions. And he said, I started to learn real quickly, you know, what people didn't know about Disneyland, what they wanted to know. She said, so I could include that in the newspaper, later the magazine and things like that. And Walt apparently was very happy with what he was doing. And Marty told me that there were two moments with Walt that just stood out in his memory. You know, after all the decades, he could remember it clearly. He could remember the sights, the sounds, how he was feeling, whether it was warm that day or whatever. So the first time was Walt came in and he asked me, you know, what I was working on. And I told him, and he looked over at Eddie Meck and he said, you know, I think we need to find something more important for this boy to do. Mm-hmm. And so by the start of 61, Walt had moved him over, or at least put him on loan to WED, which became Imagineering. And that's when Marty started to write Walt's introductions to stockholders' reports and sometimes some speeches and bits and pieces like that. And again, if you read these obits of Marty, he says, yes, I moved over to Imagineering in 61. Well, he didn't move over full time until 1964. And then a decade later, in 74, Marty became an Imagineering vice president for concepts and planning. And then in 87, for about a decade, he served as the president and vice chairman of Imagineering. Now, a lot of people are listening to this, and one of the things that when I was working at Walt Disney World is they would constantly send people to me who wanted to be a Disney animator because I had some background and experience in that, and people who wanted to be Imagineers. And there was a whole misconception about Imagineering. I had 20-year-olds come in and go, yes, I could sit in a room and dream up ideas. And I'm saying, no, there's more to Imagineering.
Oh, yeah, a whole lot more.
than that. You know, you don't only have to come up with the idea. The other part of it is engineering. You have to come up with the engineering concept, and you have to do it within budget. You know, but an engineering means something just as simple as if the attraction breaks down, how do people exit the ride vehicles? You know, do you have lights come up on the ground like they do in the aisle on an airplane or whatever? You know, one of the funniest things, of course, was when Disneyland opened in 55, right before it opened, Admiral Joe Fowler went on the Snow White's Adventures attraction, and Walt said, well, how did you enjoy it? And Fowler says, well, it's great if you want to change the name to Snow White Goes to Hell. And Walt says, there was no air conditioning in there. They had never thought ahead about air conditioning, and the heat was just building up in there. So as an Imagineer, you have to keep in mind all of these things. And interestingly enough, Walt said, Imagineering is the blending of creative imagination and technical know-how. Marty Sklar wrote that quote. When you look at Small World and the happiest cruise to ever sail around the world, Marty Sklar wrote that slogan. When you talk about Walt Disney World being the vacation kingdom of the world, Marty Sklar wrote that. And so when you're in Imagineering, there's 140 different disciplines. So you could be a show writer, you could be a show producer, you could be a show director. There's all sorts of different categories that go through there. And so when people say, oh, well, Marty Sklar, Imagineer, immediately I think what comes to people's mind is, oh, well, he designed these attractions. No, he was a writer, you know, and so writing is very important, and storytelling is very important. And in fact, his very first day, he told me at Imagineering, he met John Hench, and the two became great friends and great partners, did a lot of things, and Hench, wonderful designer. And Hench said to him, and he remembered this, Hench said, you know, this is not an I business, it's a we business. And Hench explained to him, because Hench had come from animation, that animation was a collaborative art. You know, you can say, well, Mark Davis did Maleficent. Well, yes, he did. He came up with that design, but then you have someone else doing the voice. You have an assistant animator. You have a cleanup artist. You have ink and paint. You have a writer who gives Maleficent all these wonderful words to say. So it's very hard to put your finger and say, I did this, you know, because so many different talents contributed to making that. And that was true at Imagineering, even though I fall into that same trap and say, whoa, well, this obviously was the work of Claude Coates, and this was obviously the work of Harper Goff and whatever. Basically, yes, but also other people did other things that made that happen. So the Jungle Cruise, yes, Harper Goff is coming up with this concept of a Jungle Cruise, and you're not really going to see the animals clearly, and he's coming up with the design of the boat, which is based after the Humphrey Bogart movie African Queen that he just loved. But then you've got this beautiful landscaping by Bill Evans. You've got somebody else writing the spiel for the Jungle Skippers and all of that. So, you know, it's a very collaborative thing. And in fact, I had a friend who I have a lot of friends who were Imagineers and then got laid off. But one of them, he said his first day, Marty met him and he said, "Look, I just want you to remember one thing. When you come to work here, there's only one name on the front door, and it ain't yours."
Mm-hmm.
If the satisfaction you get is from contributing, you know, to the overall team, you know, taking that. And I think if you ever heard Marty speak and all that, I don't really remember him using the word "I" an awful lot. You know, mm-hmm. "I did this," and "I did," you know, a lot of it was, you know, at best, or at worst, it was, you know, "Well, John and I went into RCA, you know, to pitch this idea," you know. It wasn't right. Like, "Yes, I came that, up that with was, this idea."
That was one of the things I always noticed. It was always "we," you know, mm-hmm. He rarely used "I." And, you know, when you're talking about writing, when one of the talks I heard him give at the Walt Disney Family Museum, he was talking mm-hmm. about writing for Walt. And one of the clips he showed was, you know, for the 10th anniversary, you know, when Walt is taking the first Disneyland ambassador, Julie Reams, mm-hmm. through, you know, what's set
through
up
the exhibits,
to the Imagineering. Yeah. And he's he said, you know, "We had a whole script. I had a whole script written for Walt." He said, "Walt approved it. We had people standing with, you know, all of the words written on cards so Walt mm-hmm. could follow along." He said, "You can tell by people's reactions, Walt just ad-libbed his way through the whole thing. And people mm-hmm. weren't, you could tell by the looks on their faces, he was saying things they weren't quite prepared for." And after, so then he showed us the clip and Walt, you know,
and it's noticeable, isn't
jokes.
It?
It's very noticeable. And Walt ad-libbed a couple of jokes, and then Marty had a very wry sense of humor, and he just said, "You try writing for that man." But, you know, the interesting thing is he said it with such affection. And anytime I heard speak about Walt, that affection and admiration he had for him was so clear. And they seemed to have an easygoing working relationship, and Marty seemed to intuitively understand what Walt wanted. And I always wondered, did Walt and Marty have any similar qualities that maybe created a unique bond between them?
I think it was basically that Marty was a great listener. Because Walt could be tremendously inarticulate. He could get you very excited and all of that, but oftentimes he left these big gaps in things, or as Marty always liked to say, Walt always liked to use the word things, you know? "Yes, in the Pirates of the Caribbean, the pirates are going to take this town and they're going to set this on fire and there's going to be some exciting things." And he said, so whenever I wrote for Walt, I said it in the word things. but he was talking about, because Marty, of course, wrote the script for the Epcot film, which actually the official title is Walt Disney's Epcot 66, but nobody ever uses that title. And he said, you know, when we were filming that, Walt would ad lib, you know, that whole point, "I'm 6 miles high," we're sitting there going, "Where'd that come from? That's not a sort of, there's nothing here." He says, you know, Walt wanted it to seem natural. He wanted it to seem as if was in his own words as it came across. And he said, you know, years later, I pulled out, I had written 7 pages of notes. And as I was starting to read over them, I go, "I didn't write that script at all. Walt wrote that script. These are all of Walt's words. And so, you know, again, he said he felt a greater impact when Walt died than even when his father died. And that was not to diminish the death of his father, but the fact that he never had to think like his father. He had to think like Walt. Mm-hmm. What would Walt say? What does Walt want to say? How does he want this said and all that? And I talked with Marty because he also did some writing for Roy. And he said, oh, it was a lot tougher for Roy. He says, because I could never get into how he was thinking. And so Marty, of course, wrote, was given only an hour. We was pulled in on the day that Walt passed away, December 15th, 1966. And he was pulled in just, you know, a half hour after, you know, they knew that Walt was dead, and they shoved him in a room and they said, you've got to write the statement for Roy Disney, but you can't talk to Roy. Roy is sequestered and in mourning and the whole bit. And Marty says, that is the one moment at Disney that still makes me the angriest. Mm-hmm. He said, they should have known that Walt, you know, was not doing well and should have had something prepared in advance. And again, Marty had worked for newspapers, and I've worked for newspapers, and they actually have a file of, you know, looks like Groucho Marx isn't going to last much longer. Why don't we do a rough obit for this? And then, you know, when he dies, it's there ready to go, and you can put in, you know, a different lead paragraph or something like that. Nothing was prepared. And so Marty had to write that, and Roy signed off on it. Marty actually wrote the dedication plaque for the Magic Kingdom that Roy read, and you know, and includes the line that this is you know, dedicated. This is an example of the a tribute to the life and philosophy of Walt Disney. And then Marty co-wrote the dedication plaque for Epcot. But yeah, this was tough. Now, Marty was never best buddies with Walt. In fact, I don't know whether Walt had any best buddies, you know, at the studio. You know, privately, friends he would have over to his house were like the Art Linkletters, Dinah Shore and her husband George Montgomery, the Kay Kaisers. Spencer Tracy was a friend, but, you know, really not studio contacts, because Walt, as he got older, felt there needed to be a distance between him and the staff in terms of an employer, you know, distance there, so that there's no conflict of interest, you know. Gee, you're my friend, how come you're not giving me a raise here? But Walt had respect for Marty, knew that Marty could do these things. And, you know, one of the things that doesn't occur to people, Marty Sklar was Jewish. And mm-hmm. not only was he Jewish.
Oh, yeah, Marty's very open about that.
Yes, not only was he Jewish, he was very Jewish. And so, you know, all of these complaints that Walt Disney was anti-Semitic, you know, Marty, you know, because I asked Marty about that. I asked Joe Grant, who is also Jewish. I asked the Sherman brothers, Richard. Richard told me, he said, look, nobody was more Jewish than us, and Walt didn't care, you know. And Marty told me the story that one time it was the High Holy Days, and Walt had tried to reach him and couldn't because, you know, you're sequestered during that time. And he said, when I got back to the office, I called up and I got his secretary, Tommy Wilk. And I said, well, what did you tell Walt? What did Walt say when you told him I was celebrating Yom Kippur? And he just said, she didn't hesitate. She said, Walt said, well, that's where he should be with his family. And that was it. You know, and so all of this nonsense that, oh, well, Walt was anti-Semitic. You know, I saw that on Family Guy. I saw that on Robot Chicken, whatever. That was not the case whatsoever.
Yeah.
Here he's got, you know, and as you said, Marty made no it didn't try to hide being, you know, Jewish. You know, some people did because there was all of that backlash. And Walt just said, no. Walt felt, as long as you can do the job, I don't care. You know, it's something that many people to this day don't realize. Bob Gurr was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, I talked with Bob. Bob's a good friend. And he said, didn't make any difference to Walt. It wasn't a big deal. He said, as long as I did what I needed to get done, that was fine with him. He felt it wasn't any of my business.
Yeah.
You know, and yet now that I guess I'm all steamed up because I saw the rerun of that PBS American Experience documentary.
I wouldn't watch it
and
again.
And Bob told me the best way of watching that, Jim, is turn off the sound and just watch the images, which are great, which are amazing, things I had never seen before. But it was obvious that the filmmakers had already gone in with
an agenda,
a pre-planned agenda, you know.
Yeah, we've talked about that on this show. And yeah, I heard Richard Sherman. I know we're getting off on a tangent. I heard Richard Sherman when I heard him speak, and he addressed this issue. And he said Walt didn't know Richard had heard this, but Walt had been stopped in a hallway by a lawyer. And I don't know what they're talking about.
One of the Disney lawyers,
Yeah, he made a derogatory statement about the Sherman brothers being Jewish, and Walt dismissed him.
Right then and there, yes,
yeah.
Without hesitation.
Yeah.
You know, and again, you know, there were people working at the Disney studio who were anti-Semitic, but, you know, oftentimes Walt didn't know that, that sometimes people who were of the Jewish faith were getting, you know, the cold shoulder or a snarky remark or whatever. And none of it ever came from Walt. And we're really not off topic because Marty Sklar loved the Sherman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's why, you know, one of his books is called One Little Spark there. And in fact, when Epcot was being built, Marty goes, look, it's been years since we've had an attraction that had, you know, a theme song or whatever. Bring back the Sherman Brothers. And so Epcot revitalized using memorable theme songs in Disney attractions. And unfortunately, some of the theme songs they wrote aren't there anymore. I remember the one for the Kodak Pavilion, you know,
Making Memories?
Making Memories.
Love
that song.
That's a cute one, yeah. Once in a while, you hear it in the Magic Kingdom on Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, but people don't know where it comes from, so. So, anyway, in terms of, for young listeners, Marty Sklar was the only person in the Disney company to be at the grand opening of all 12 Disney theme parks worldwide. And he pretty much contributed significantly to, I would say, at least 9 of them. Mm-hmm. You know, and also over the years, he's mentored, I would say, at least 2 different generations of theme park designers who either work for Disney or work outside the company. And I know Bob Rogers is a huge fan of what Marty did there. So,
now after
what else do you want to talk about Marty?
Well, after Walt's passing in 1966, you know, Marty carried on Walt's philosophy of design, creativity, you know, exploring new technology, putting guest experience first in the parks and resorts. So in your opinion, who's had more influence on the parks, Walt Disney or Marty Sklar?
Well, I think that's an easy question. It's obviously Walt, because what Marty was doing was he was trying to reinforce what Walt did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where the Mickey Ten Commandments come from, you know. So Marty wasn't trying to put his own fingerprint on things. He was basically, how would Walt have done this? What would Walt have wanted? And so that's why the Walt impact is much more significant than Marty's impact, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, and it seemed like Marty also shared Walt's optimism, and he worked to keep Walt's optimism in the attractions and in the parks.
Yes, yes. And you know, we were talking about the American Experience documentary, and it's trying to paint Walt as this dark soul who is struggling against the darkness, and that really wasn't who Walt was. You know, Walt was all about optimism, that it's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day. And as Marty said, the whole concept of Epcot was optimism, that the future is going to be better. And if you give people, you know, the right information, the right tools, they're good, and they'll use those and make the future better. And I think optimism is another thing that kept Marty there for longer than some of the others who were, you know, shown the door.
Yeah, well, that's what I was wondering, because, you know, he had to work and consider the interests of various CEOs of the company, the leadership of the theme park, sponsoring corporations, you know, Imagineers, stockholders, park guests. I always wondered, how did he manage to do this and remain with the company for 54 years?
Obviously, he knew what he was doing. And again, one of his, you know, we say, well, he didn't design an attraction. One of his major responsibilities was being a liaison to these companies like RCA and United Technologies and all of this, and you know, and he could be firm. You know, we're talking about maintaining the Walt Disney approach is that you know, that if you take a look at attractions, it's living seas presented by United Technologies. The name of the company that is sponsoring the attraction is always secondary. And sometimes that's a good thing, because sometimes, you know, sponsors and lessees, you know, move. And where Marty learned that was from watching Walt at the 64-65 World's Fair, and how Walt dealt with these companies. And so Marty was then mimicking that and imitating that when they were bringing in participants and lessees and sponsors for Epcot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that was one of his first big jobs too, wasn't it? Was getting the sponsors for the 64-65 World's Fair.
Yes. Yes.
Too. Yeah.
You know, and again, it's not an easy job. You know, one of the a familiar story. And again, you know, oftentimes that's why I'm glad I have this opportunity to tell some of these stories, because while Marty was alive, it was like, well, those are Marty's stories to tell. You know, and he's out and he's doing a lot of interviews, especially when the books came out, and you know, a lot of presentations. You mentioned the Walt Disney Family Museum, but he was all over the place, you know, and a very, very engaging speaker. And you're right, he had that great sense of wit. And if you looked at his face, there was almost sort of that mischievous expression, you know.
Yes, it was like a little boy sort of mischievous grin that he would have.
Yes, almost like, well, I put my hand in the cookie jar here. But the whole thing about Space Mountain was, it was not originally going to be Space Mountain. It was going to be a trip through a computer, and they went to RCA. He and John Hinch, you know, to pitch this, and they had like 9 storyboards set up and all of this, and so they're ready to go. And then General Sarnoff comes in, and they go, well, General Sarnoff sits at the head of the table, which was like a mile away. And so, you know, they don't want to say anything, so they're going through this whole pitch, and Sarnoff writes a little note, folds it up, hands it to the person next to him. He looks at it and, you know, passes down the row, and then eventually gets to Marty, and he opens up the note, and it says, "Who are these people?" So he hadn't even been told, you know, well, this is Disney, and they're pitching this idea and all of that. And so Marty was steamed, and he and John, you know, were commiserating later, and then Marty says, you know, the mistake we made is we're trying to give them what they think they want. What we should do is we should give them the best thing that we've got. And so John had done up a design of Space Mountain for a spaceport that, mm-hmm. that Walt had wanted to include in Tomorrowland at Disneyland. And so they put this together, and then they went back and they insisted that Card Walker and Don Tatum come with them. And they set up the boards and all this, and they looked and they said, they were told again, well, you know, General Sarnoff sits at the head of the Marty says, I'm talking to the person who's sitting in this chair right here. If General Sarnoff's up there, my back's going to be towards him. And so what they did is they came in and they filled up all the chairs except that one. And somebody said, well, Mr. Sarnoff, the Disney people would like you to sit there. And Sarnoff goes, oh, yeah, fine. Sits there. And they pitch him Space Mountain. And, you know, it goes over tremendously, you know. And Marty got very upset, you know. He says, we shouldn't call these things rides, you mm-hmm. know. He says those vehicles are not a ride. They're a way of taking people through the story. There are different ways of taking people through a story. The vehicle is just, you know, the way in this attraction that you take people through the story. Mm-hmm. You know, it is not a ride. You know, marketing was originally going to call Star Tours Star Rides. And Marty led, you know, a vehement... you know, discussion of we do not have rides here. And then Imagineer Tom Fitzgerald, who I think was either show director or show producer, came up with the term Star Tours. But it was going to be called Star Rides for that to happen. And again, I think the lasting legacy of Marty is not just those contributions he made, but the philosophy about theme park design, the philosophy of Disney, and you know, we see that he writes about it in his books, thank heavens, and he loved doing that at the speeches, and he said a wonderful example which I loved, and then later he told me where it came from. And I'm sure we've heard lots of Marty philosophies. One of them is, of course, you know, the blank page. Mm-hmm. You know, the blank page can be one of the most frightening things in the world because there's nothing on it. And as a writer, I will tell you that when I start writing and that page is absolutely blank, there's nothing for me to there's nothing. I go, holy heck! How am I going to start? Where am I going to go? Or, Marty says, you can look at it as there's nothing on it, so there's endless possibilities. And he continually brought up that example, and I thought, that is so cool. And one time after a speech, I was sitting and I was talking to him, and I said, that is so cool. How did you come up with that? And he said, well, he said, I was on the Board of Education for the Anaheim City Schools. I said, I didn't know. He said, oh, yeah, I was on there twice. And I was board president. And he said, I also was working with the Anaheim City Library at the same time. And we came up with this writing competition for this young man who had passed away from cancer. And that writing competition, creative writing competition, lasted at least 25 years. I hope it's still going on now that Marty's no longer there. And he said, so the first year, for the first award ceremony, I brought down Ray Bradbury, and Ray Bradbury talked. And everybody's all excited. He says, but now we've got to do it a second year, you know, and how do you top Ray Bradbury, you know, talking about Ray? He said, so I decided, okay, I'll bring down, you know, some of the Imagineers, you know, a small group, a half dozen of the Imagineers, and they can talk, and you know, we'll tie it in with creativity and all this. And so he says, you know, getting Imagineers to agree on anything is next to impossible. So we're sitting and, you know, debating back and forth. And he said, one of the guys in the communications division came with a sheet of paper, and on it he had printed the most frightening thing in the world. And I looked at that and I thought, yes, yes. And I'm talking with these other people. And then Walt Paragoy. And for those of you who don't know Walt Paragoy, you should, you know, you should Google him and all that. He was a background artist on a couple of the Disney animated features like 101 Dalmatians and Sword in the Stone. And then he became an Imagineer. He's the one who designed the mosaic that goes into the land at Epcot, among other things. But so Paragoy has this fiery temper, and he's a maverick. And Marty says he slammed his hand down on the table, and he says, if that's what we're talking about, I'm not going. And Marty goes, well, what are you talking about? And he says, no, the blank piece of paper, this is the most amazing thing in the world. He says, because nobody has made a mark on it, so you don't have to, you know, adjust to something or adapt to something that's there. And he says, and if you give that blank piece of paper to a kid, he says, it's not enough. They'll go beyond the borders of the paper, you know, because they've got so much that they want to do and all of that. And so Marty took those two concepts and joined them together, and that's how that wonderful Marty story that's out there that we go through is like, okay, that works for me.
You know, now in the last few years, and we were talking about this earlier, we've experienced the passing of many who worked directly with Walt Disney. What effect do you think the loss of this institutional knowledge and direct connection with Walt will have on the company as it moves into the future?
Not a great one. We lose these people. Like last year, we lost Jack Lindquist, and he was in the middle of doing another book. And we lost Charlie Ridgway, and he was in the middle of doing another book. And so, you know, there's not a lot of time left. Most of these people really do have expiration dates, because if they knew Walt, even if they knew Walt, you know, when they were like 20, you know, they're in their 80s or 90s now. Everybody that I interviewed who knew Walt felt that there was just this sense of awe about him. He didn't promote this. He really tried to promote himself as sort of a common man, and would sometimes, you know, misbutton his coat or his sweater or whatever, or crumple up his hat or whatever. So he seems like a regular guy, so you can talk to him, which is what he wanted. But there was just this, you know, we're going to do this, and the guest comes first, and quality comes first, you know. Don't tell me, you know, I when they were working on Walt Disney World, I think Joe Fowler told him at one meeting, but Walt, this is going to cost us $2 million. And Walt blew up at him and said, you know, don't bother me about inconsequential things. What we need is, you know, is this. And he also brought out the best in people, but there was that very, very solid, you know, the guests are the ultimate importance, and you need to put yourself in the guests' shoes. I remember him telling John Hench, you know, if the guests don't get the story, it's not their fault. It's our problem that we didn't tell that story clearly. And then quality, you know, you do the quality and people will pay you back. And already we've seen those two aspects being chipped away and chipped away. And, you know, as a result of, you know, we need to balance, you know, cost effectiveness with creativity. And you start to see Disney buying more and more things, you know, off the shelf, you know, in the parks especially, you know. And you see Disney looking to, instead of create new franchises, purchase franchises, whether it's the Muppets or Marvel or Star Wars or whatever, and then work on that instead of, you know, tapping into your creative people. When I started work at Walt Disney World in 1995, there were 2,000 Imagineers. Today, there's maybe about two dozen. All the others are independent contractors. Many of them were Imagineers who were laid off. And if you have somebody from the outside come in, they're not going to have that same level of investment. And I've seen a good friend of mine is Sully Sullivan, who worked 49 and a half years for Walt Disney Company. And I said, Sully, 49 and a half years. You couldn't have held out six more months to go for the... He says, no. He says, what I saw happening and all that, he says, I left when I had to leave. I couldn't handle it anymore. And he just doesn't go back into the parks anymore. You know, and so I think losing some of these people, and especially losing, you know, Marty Sklar. And sometimes I didn't like the fact that he was playing, you know, good soldier and was always trying to say, well, Walt never wanted this to be a museum. Well, but, you know, Walt had a respect for certain things and he never took anything out unless he put something 10 times better, you know, in its place. And I'm not seeing that happen. But Marty was one of those final voices to say, you know, Walt would probably, because we can make a guess what the Walt of 1966 might have said, although even then he surprised people. What the Walt of 2017 would do, who knows, right? With all this technology and all of this, we know that Walt would have been involved with all of that. Disney would have been involved with the social media 20 years ago, you know, if Walt was still around. But more effectively than it is today. But I think with the passing of people like Marty and Jack and Charlie and so many others who actually knew Walt, actually worked with Walt, and got that pixie dust of not only this is how we do it, but this is why we do it this way. And I don't see that in the training now. At Walt Disney World, traditions training for new hires used to be 3 days. And that included a trip into the park as well to physically see, you know, the things that they were hearing in the classroom. Now, traditions is down to 4 hours. They'll pick it up once they're in the parks. No, they won't. Or they'll pick up, you know, the wrong things from cast members who are there, you know, and let me get my grumpy old man cane out and wave it in the air. Get those kids off my lawn. That music's too loud. But I think we're going to see, and we already are seeing, you know, a much different Disney theme park experience. Now, granted, that audience has changed. And the stories they want to hear and how they want it told are different. But for me, something like Pirates of the Caribbean or even Small World still work. You know, they're still classic. I still get value, and it's something for, you know, what Walt wanted, everybody. So you don't divide people. You know, I think one of the challenges that Disney is facing now is that technology divides people. And it's not just those iPhones and apps and things like that. I think of Pandora when you have the Banshee ride.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people who literally cannot ride that attraction. You know, it will do things to them physically that, you know, and in Walt's day, that wasn't the case. Well, I guess the teacups, you know, stay away from the teacups. But, you know, even then you could go on the teacups and not spin the center disc and have a pleasant experience there. But now we have, you know, so many limitations and all that that we're dividing up that experience, and we're pricing people out of things. Earlier today, I went with my brother to the studios, which to my dying day I will call the MGM Studios, because I wanted to see the Walt Disney Presents, which is the new version of One Man's Dream there. And I also wanted to see Voyage of the Little Mermaid, because I had heard that that's on the chopping block. And as we're driving in, you know, there's that big sign, you know, premium parking is available today for $40. It's like, really? I guess people must be paying that. That's why you're offering that. But I don't think Walt would have wanted that type of elite separation. But again, saying that, the company would not be as financially successful today if Walt was in charge, because Walt would have invested everything back into the park. And so there would have been nothing for the stockholders except, you know, nickels and dimes type of thing. Where's that grumpy old man, Kane?
Yeah.
Not only is that music loud, I can't understand the lyrics. Get out of here. But I think the Disney theme park experience is going, if I want to be Marty Sklar good soldierish, I would say it's going to be a different experience here in the future, now that we have left those who continued to carry, you know, Walt's torch. And for me, but I'm an old guy, I'm saddened by that.
Yeah, so am I. So, but it'll be interesting to see how it transforms. But now, as you mentioned earlier, Marty retired from the Walt Disney Company and Walt Disney Imagineering on July 17th, 2009, which was Disneyland's 54th anniversary. And he was honored with a window on Main Street USA in Disneyland on his final day. And it is in Disneyland City Hall, where his office was located, that you had mentioned.
Right.
In 2001.
He's also got a window at the other parks too. Magic Kingdom has one. Tokyo Disneyland, which he loved, and he said, you know, what we learned at Tokyo Disneyland was, you know, things don't always translate. He says, so on the Jungle Cruise, he said, interestingly enough, he says, the joke about the mother-in-law still gets a laugh, but other things didn't. So we had to bring in people from outside to, you know, rewrite it in the idiom of that culture, you know. And, you know, I think if people want to remember Marty for a particular project, the particular project obviously should be Epcot, you know. And the first time he visited Florida, you know, he was a California boy. First time he visited Florida was October 67. went out on Mickey Mouse 1, that Gulfstream 1. He was 33 years old. And he said, yeah, you know, he came out with John Hench and I think Dick Irvine, who was head of WED at that point, and all of that. And he said, and then they left, and they left me there. and he had to spend 3 days flying over the property on a helicopter, taking pictures and motion pictures and all that. And at that time, there was only 100 acres that had been cleared for the Magic Kingdom. Everything else was this jungle, bug-filled swamp, you know, which is why he's doing it, you know, from the helicopter up there. But after Magic Kingdom opened, you know, he and Hench, you know, really pushed for Epcot. And Epcot and World Showcase were supposed to be actually two separate locations. The monorail was supposed to stop between them. Mm-hmm. So one day you would take the monorail, and when you got off, you went to the right, and you went to Future World. And then the next day you took the monorail, and you went to the left, and you went to World Showcase. But what was happening is there was not enough money, and they couldn't find enough sponsors. So for the final pitch, basically what happened is Marty shoved the Future World model and Hench shoved the World Showcase model so that they came together. And then Hench went to his room and got a can of blue paint and painted a lake in between the middle of them. and they sold it that way. Although they did have to take out, you know, some elements because again it's the cost there. But that was it. And while Marty said that, you know, he loved Disneyland because again that's the first park, that's the park where Walt walked, that was the first park, you know, he saw open and all of that. He said a very close second. The one that I really love is I love Epcot. And one of the reasons I love Epcot is because it's very different than any other Disney park, at least when it was built and for many years, because it provided real stories, real information. It wasn't magic and fantasy and all of that. It was information. And he said the two pavilions that he absolutely loved was the land and Living with the Seas. And the reason for that is because you could actually go into those pavilions and see things being done. You could see plants being grown and the hydroponics and all that. And in the Living Seas, you could see how they were taking care of the fish and all of that. And he said that was very much what Walt wanted, was that showcase. And he said, so I'm so proud of that. And then he said, you know, Animal Kingdom came along later and did something similar. He said, but Epcot was there first, and it could have been so much more. But, you know, it was what it was.
Yeah, I know when I talked to him about it a few years ago, he was very disappointed that Future World was turning away from the information educational part of its mission, and he thought they could get it back. They could do it. They did it right.
Talk to me. I'm happy to have you on my podcast here, but why don't we have you tell us about your encounters with Marty and your impressions?
Oh gosh, well I sort of talked about them
you sort of agreed with some of the ones that I did, but. But yeah. But do you have a favorite Marty story? Do you have if 20 years from now a young Disney historian comes up to you and says, what was Marty Sklar like in person? What would you say?
For me, what really struck me was his sense of humor, because mm-hmm. I love, because he had that little hint of sarcasm.
Yes,
in there
yes.
that I really appreciated. But I just have to say it was just his dedication to Walt and Walt's philosophy and of what the parks were about. Mm-hmm. And that just that he really wanted to carry that on. And that,
and he always seemed to have that sense of authority that he really did seem to know what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he had this ability, like you were saying earlier. He got in Walt's head. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's remarkable. And I think that's why when Walt passed away, I think that, I mean, it just shook him to his core.
To his core. And, yeah. And I think it still did decades later.
You yes. Know?
I think that was still very much a part of his DNA. And you know, I commend him for being, you know, such a great political player, because it kept him around so that, you know, he could do some of those commando little things in the background that kept people on track. And then he could also communicate this to new Imagineers so that, you know, mm-hmm. and lead them in the right direction.
Yeah. And also I talked to him when he was in the midst of writing his first book, and he had this portfolio. He hand wrote his books. I mean, all by hand, and he had these post-it notes, because he either was going to the archives or he had just come back from the archives, and mm-hmm. and everything was written out. And he said he has somebody else, you know, transcribe them. But
right.
But I thought, oh my goodness, he hand wrote
yeah,
out.
And he actually built a little room to work on writing the book, and he built it so that the walls were pinnable. So you could actually pin up sections, and then he could move it around just like a storyboard, you know. And because I asked him, how come you didn't? I thought, well, you know, it's being published by Disney Editions, and I know that they go over these things very carefully because they don't want to, you know, disrupt the Disney brand. I said, so how come you left out this story and this story? And he said, well, it was just because of the flow of what I wanted to tell. This made sense. He says, I'm going to write another book. In fact, he told me one of the books he wanted to write was at Imagineering. They had a wall where, you know, they if he heard a terrific quote or something, he would write it down on an index card and pin it up on the wall. So, for instance, George Lucas said, the reason cliches are cliches is because they work. And Card Walker was talking to John Cushman, who was a contractor building Epcot, and Card said, are we going to have any trouble meeting October 1st, 1982? And Cushman said, October 1st was never a problem. 1982 is the problem. And so I said, oh, what a great idea. And he says, yeah, I'd like to do that. And he said he also saved dozens of sketches that were done in Imagineering meetings, basically doodles by people like John Hench and Joe Rohde and Herb Ryman and all that. He saved all of that stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And it's like, oh.
That'd be wonderful.
There's a Disney historian, Didier Getz. And
oh, yeah.
When Marty died, he said one of the tragedies, he says there's a lot of tragedy connected with this. He said one of these tragedies is that he still had so many stories left to tell that only he knew.
Now you mentioned Herb Ryman. I know one of the charities that Marty and his wife Leah really supported was the Ryman Arts.
Actually, they were one of the original founders too. The mm-hmm. the Ryman Arts, yeah.
Can you tell us a little about Ryman Arts?
Why? Sure. It's not like we've gone over the amount of time that we're allotted. We have plenty of time to talk about all sorts of things.
Yeah, well, just briefly in a nutshell.
Okay. Basically, Herb Ryman, terrific artist, worked on Disney animated films, but then he's probably best known for, you know, doing the sketch that, you know, sold Disneyland and the design for the Sleeping Beauty Castle, also the design for Cinderella Castle out here. So when he passed away, Marty and his wife were among, I think there were six original founders that created the Ryman Arts Foundation, and its purpose was to teach traditional drawing and painting skills to talented young artists in Southern California. And because, you know, especially in Southern California, they were cutting back on public art education and all of that. And so basically, you know, 150 high school artists each year, you know, are supported. They provide 2,500 full scholarships to Southern California students, you know, to go on. And and something that many people don't know is that Marty and his wife Leah established the Martin and Leah Sklar Scholarship for Ryman Program Graduates at CalArts. Mm-hmm. So that's there as well. And so a lot of the funding from this comes from the sale of Herb Ryman's art. You know, there's a lot of that around. There's an auction. It's a charity and all of that. And you know, we keep mentioning Marty's wife. They got married in 1957.
Wow.
And they had two kids, a son who became a teacher and a daughter who I think worked in motion pictures doing script reading and analysis. And then they had four grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting life. Interesting
yeah,
life.
Yeah. Now, Marty did
receive. And so, you know, 83 years old. So you go, my gosh, look what this guy has done. You know, what have That's I done amazing. With my life? It's not even a blip on his resume here. But it's still sad that he's not around, and I won't be able to hear him and listen to these great stories.
Yeah. Well, now, he did receive a number of awards. In 2001, he was recognized as a Disney legend. He mm-hmm. received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Theme Entertainment Association, TIA, in 1995. He was inducted into the International Association of Amusement Parks and Attractions, or IAPA, Hall of Fame. In 2016, he was awarded the Diane Disney Miller Lifetime Achievement Award from the Walt Disney Family Museum.
I think he was the first one to get that, too, yeah.
He was, and he served on its advisory board. He was a great friend of the museum. And and he wrote two books, Dream It, Do It, My Half Century Creating Disney's Magic Kingdoms, and One Little Spark, The Road to Imagineerings. And, of course, these books will continue to spark and inspire the imaginations of generations to come. So,
And so for those of you listening, those should be added to your Disney library, especially if you're interested in Imagineering or, you know, how Imagineering does that. And then, of course, Mickey's Ten Commandments, which he expanded, I think, to what, 40?
Yeah, I have that sitting here, at least the first version of it.
Yes.
So, very
fascinating, very, very articulate. And as you pointed out, you know, very much a champion for maintaining Walt's spirit, mm-hmm. you know,
absolutely.
At Disney, you know, yeah. For that to happen, you yeah. know. And when you're picking up Marty's books and you're looking on Amazon, don't forget to look for Jim Korkis, KORKIS.
That was my next little lead in here, Jim. You are the author of over 20 Disney related books.
Yes, so isn't that amazing that I have that much to say?
So can you tell our listeners a little more about that and, you know, how they can get a hold of your books?
Yes. Again, one of the things that struck me was as people started to pass away, it was like wait a minute. I sat down and I talked with this person and I took notes and, you know, and they're not around anymore. And he told me these stories and those stories aren't out there. And so I felt a responsibility to help keep their memory alive by sharing those stories. And then I also saw an awful lot of inaccurate material out there that people had a tendency to cut and paste and like, well, if it's on the internet, it must be true. Or if it's in a book, it must be true. And that's not necessarily the case. So my very first book, The Vault of Walt, has a foreword by Diane Disney Miller, who was a huge supporter. And she wanted me to do more to get that material out there. And so there are five books in the Vault of Walt series. There's a sixth one coming out at Christmas time, and divided into four sections. One section has stories about Walt Disney. Another section has stories about Disney films, both animated and live action. Another section has stories about the theme parks. And then the fourth section is miscellaneous, like how Disney housekeeper, Thelma Howard, passed away as a millionaire and didn't realize it because Walt would give her stock certificates on her birthday and at Christmas and told her, hang on to these. These are going to be worth something someday. And so she never looked at them. And then with stock splits and all this, she was a millionaire when she died and had no clue whatsoever. And so there's several stories in each section. Another series that has proven very popular, and I moved out to Walt Disney World in 1995, fall of 1995, and I worked in entertainment, and I worked for Imagineering, I worked for Disney University, Disney Institute, and along the way I picked up, you know, a lot of great information, and it doesn't appear in any books. So I wrote a book called Secret Stories of Walt Disney World, which was a selection of stories about the theme parks and the resorts and the area outside the resorts, like Typhoon Lagoon and all of that, and then some miscellaneous history stuff. Each chapter is only 2 pages long, because I know we have short attention spans, but all of the information in there is accurate. I went to at least three different sources, independent sources, as opposed to, well, this source agrees with this, but it looks like they just cut and pasted it from here. And so there are three books in the Secret Stories of Walt Disney World series, and then just this last year, I wrote a book, Secret Stories of Disneyland, because I was starting to see, I thought, I'm never going to write a book about Disneyland. My gosh, there's so many books out there. There's so many websites. There's so many podcasts. There's so many, you know, but a lot of that stuff was completely wrong. So I wrote Secret Stories of Disneyland, including the story of the two known Nazis who influenced the design of Disneyland. In fact, one of them was not just a Nazi, he was an SS officer. And he was not just an SS officer, he was Adolf Hitler's chief interrogation officer. And in fact, he was so effective and so important that the U.S. military sort of fudged on the paperwork to get him, after the war, transferred to the United States so he could teach his techniques to the U.S. military. But he worked on Disneyland. He also worked on Walt Disney World. You'll have to buy the book to find that out.
Yeah.
And I write a bunch of other books, too. One of my worst-selling books, I loved writing it, but one of my worst-selling books was called Walt's Words, which are quotes, direct quotes from Walt Disney, not paraphrased or anything like that, and each quote lists the date that it was said, where Walt said it, the context in which it was said, and it's divided up into 24 different categories. So there's a category of his quotes on women, his category of quotes on animation, on on animals. And I thought, everybody, their mother is going to want this book. Nobody or their mother wants this book.
I bought it. I'm looking at it right now because I have two rooms of Disney books. And in my study, I have the ones I use regularly. That one's in my study. Because I do pull that one out regularly.
So you're the one who bought the book. Thank you.
Apparently so.
But there's that. And in fact, this last week, I just turned in the manuscript for my latest book, which will be out early November. It may be out late October. It may be out early November. And would you like a hint? Because it's already in the process. All it's going through now is the editing and format and all that. Would you like a hint of what this book is going to be about?
Oh, absolutely. You're always good about giving our listeners sneak previews. So,
yes. It's going to be about 200 pages. So, I will tell you that 1/4 of the book is devoted to chapters debunking myths about Walt Disney.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
So there's a chapter about how Walt was not frozen. There's a chapter about how Walt was not anti-Semitic. There's a chapter about how Walt was not an FBI informant. There's a chapter about how Walt was not born in Spain. And this is not the case of my just saying, well, this just doesn't seem to make sense, you know, knowing Walt. Every chapter has documentation. So, for instance, Walt was not frozen. I interviewed the only cryogenics company that existed when Walt passed away. I interviewed Forest Lawn and got a copy of the death certificate with the name of the embalmer, or actually the person who cremated Walt, state stamp and all of that. And even after doing all of that, I showed this to a friend of mine, and her response was, well, you know, documents can be forged.
Oh, of course. But I remember during one of your talks at the Walt Disney Family Museum, you did a Q&A afterwards. I think you were talking about Walt and the space program. And this question invariably came up. And Diane Disney Miller was in the audience, and she stood up and she debunked it, but she talked about how much pain that story causes her family.
Yes, it gave the whole family because her children were. She told me this. Her children in elementary school were constantly being asked, "Isn't your grandfather frozen?"
Yeah, but she talked about where they finally tracked down the publication that originated.
Chapter.
Okay, well, they'll have to read the book to find that out.
Yes.
But I was there. I heard it from Diane.
And Diane, what a wonderful, wonderful person, and what a loss. What, you know, a tragic accident.
Yes.
You know, Diane was in better shape than I was when I was 20. You know, when I was there at the museum, you know, she would bound up those steps two at a time.
Two at a time, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And boy, she was a maverick, and she was, you know, she would not suffer fools lightly.
No, she would
but,
not.
But yes, that question keeps coming up. And so questions that keep getting tossed at me. Well, Walt Disney was court-martialed, right? No, he wasn't court-martialed, you know. He was racist. No, he wasn't racist. You know, in fact, if you just took a look at the recent PBS documentary on Tai Wong, he's a Chinese artist who, you know, was the main concept artist for Bambi, for crying out loud, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but yes, a fourth of the book goes through, there's 12 chapters, each chapter debunks, a myth about Walt Disney. The rest of the book is filled with material that has never appeared in print before.
Ah, we'll look forward to
it's not a reworking of that. And again, it'll come out by the beginning of November or the end of October. It's in the hands of the publisher now who goes through and does the editing and the layout. And
okay.
And so this will be
and
out
we will
soon.
Have
then,
a link. What? Mm-hmm.
Yes, have a link to Amazon.com and also
ThemeParkPress.com. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us on Connecting with Walt to share your memories of Marty
Sklar. This was always a joy. Always a joy to talk to people who are passionate about Disney. And may all your days be Disney days.
Thank you. Well, Jim shared some great stories about Marty Sklar.
Yeah, he's just always just packed full of more stories than you can ever expect. And all just so fascinating.
Yeah, he is. And he has great insights. It's wonderful that, you know, he met Marty and had all these notes. He had told us before the show that in preparation for the show, he went into his archive of notes and shared stories he that Jim had not even yet written down anywhere. So that was a very nice plus for all of for our Connecting with Walt family. So I'm glad we were able to give Marty a tribute that, you know, he deserves, especially for all of us on Connecting with Walt, you know, all, who have an appreciation for Disney history and for how Marty carried on that connection with Walt, you know, in the theme parks throughout his life. So next week, Craig and I will step into the future as we take you through the history of the Great Big Beautiful Tomorrowland. So, Craig, until then, where can our listeners see you on the Diz Unplugged network of shows?
I am here and there and everywhere, basically on every show throughout the week on the Diz Unplugged channel. So you throw a rock, chances are you are going to hit me in some way, shape, or form. But yes, that's where I'll be. And Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, but when the next episode is released, you will be traveling, won't you?
I will. I wasn't going to drop that one until the last episode, and I'll say, hey, guess what? I haven't really been here this whole time.
We'll preserve the secret then.
Okay. So, but yes, we're going to have a very special episode for you at the end of the month.
Yeah.
Although you'll probably figure it out if you listen to the Disneyland show when I'm suddenly gone. but no, we can talk about it. As Craig mentioned a little earlier in the show that we do record these in advance. We're recording these well in advance because I am fortunate enough to be joining the Diz on the Dreams Unlimited Travel China Adventures by Disney tour. So as you're listening to our October episodes, I'm traveling Japan and China with a whole lot of Dizzers. So I'm sure I'm having a wonderful time.
Well, I hope you're having like a once in a lifetime trip right now.
Oh, this is a once in a lifetime trip, believe me. And so the final episode of this month's series will be my talking about the trip, sharing what connections to Walt did I find in you know the Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Shanghai parks, as well as some of the other sites that I saw, and my other adventures, and I'm sure I'll have a couple of misadventures to share as well. So,
wouldn't be a trip without them.
No. And you can find me most Sunday nights on the Diz Unplugged podcast, Disneyland Edition, with my good friends Tom Bell, Nancy Johnson, Mary Jo Malata-Willey, and Tony Spittel, where we have lots of fun talking about Walt's park that started it all, and all Southern California theme parks, as well as the Walt Disney Family Museum, and even more Disney history. And you can listen to us live on Mixlr, Sundays at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, Disneyland Time. And you can download our two weekly shows, reviews from iTunes each Monday. And if you would like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studio, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, you can check out our Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes, and you can look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings. And as Craig did mention in a previous episode, we are going to start, over the course of time, moving my history episodes from the Disneyland show over to the Connecting with Walt feed, so that it'll all be one-stop shopping.
Yes,
For Disney history. Although we're not going to do it all at once. We are going to sort of string it out.
Exactly. We'll sprinkle it here and there when we need to.
It'll be like pixie dust. We'll just sprinkle it here and there. You can send me messages at Twitter at mbowling121. I lost my page here. You think I would know all this by heart, wouldn't you? But yes, Facebook, I'm Michael Bowling. On Instagram, I'm
Michael Bowling the Diz.
Thank you. I just found it too. So anyway, all my pages from Jim just are all shuffled up here.
Yeah.
So anyway.
It's a good thing I listen every week.
Yes. Thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother Roy.